This is the June 4 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Patrick DeHaan from GasBuddy.com, Merrill Crowley of First Choice Commodities out of Watsika, Illinois, Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri Marketing out of Morton, Illinois, and Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting in Waco, Texas. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org, or look us up in your favorite podcast applications, including Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, and Google and Apple Podcast. Now, let's turn our attention to Patrick DeHaan from GasBuddy.com. He's our special guest for the week. Thank you, Patrick, for being with us. You're the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com. Can you tell me what GasBuddy is and what your title means?
Well, GasBuddy is a price tracking website where motorists can find the lowest prices in their community all across the U.S. and in Canada as well. Being the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy, what I do is basically break down oil and gasoline prices to help educate them on where prices may go, the trends, and further analysis, and basically kind of a value addition to our app that we have.
Well, a couple of quick questions that I have. I believe that OPEC met again this week. Did they come to any decisions?
Well, OPEC was mulling over meeting and when they were going to meet. In early June, they tend to have a meeting in early June, but there was amongst it some disagreement on exactly what they were going to be doing at that meeting. So there is some discontent again wrangling with OPEC and Russia. I think this is really an OPEC issue and Russia issue, Saudi Arabia and Russia being the two that are kind of going at each other here. And Saudi Arabia certainly a little bit more susceptible to the current low price of oil, which sits at about $37 a barrel today, whereas the Russians can survive on lower oil prices and may not want to curb production for an extended amount of time like the Saudis may to boost the price of oil back up closer to where their economy would need it to be.
I thought it was the other way around. Can you explain to me what the analysis is there that lets the Russians be the lowest cost producer?
Well, at least at this point, it's all based on budgetary spending in each of those countries. Saudi Arabia's prime source of revenue is oil. And so more of their budget is reliant on whatever the price of oil may be. The Russian economy is a little bit more diverse than the price of oil, though oil still makes up a big part of it. And so they're a little bit more insulated to the lower price of oil. And that's where you see disagreement is. As Saudi Arabia has seen increases in the last 10, 20 years in the price of oil, their budget has gone up. And so now they're at a point where they are more reliant on that oil revenue. And as a result, that spending then really requires them or basically outlines that they need to sell oil for upwards of $60 a barrel to be able to have that spending, whereas Russia does not necessarily need as high of a price for oil for their budget to be non-impacted.
Just as the United States was going into the COVID-19 or coronavirus pandemic, the Russians and the Saudis agreed, relatively speaking, to open the spigot up. And the lack of demand, because cars weren't moving in the United States because of the pandemic, and the increase in oil and influx pushed the price of oil into the $20 a barrel level. It's of course, rebounded since then, as you said. Can you tell me about the demand and usage over that period and what you think will happen in the summertime? And this is directly related from our perspective in agriculture to the use of corn, as it is a 10% blend in all gasoline across the United States that is sold, or most of it, that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, gasoline demand has certainly struggled amidst the pressure of shelter-in-place orders that at one point had affected a bulk over 80% of U.S. states. Gasoline demand fell from Its winter low, which typically is somewhere in the upper 8, low 9 million barrel per day range, all the way down to under 6 million barrels a day. In fact, there's possible that the first week in April, in which Gas Buddy data points out was the weakest of the weeks, that gasoline demand slipped under 5 million barrels. So basically half of what we see during the summer is what we saw during coronavirus. And so that certainly had far-reaching impacts on the price of oil, oil-producing countries, and like you mentioned, the price of ethanol as well. Not only the price of ethanol had struggled due to Trump's feud with China, basically undermining the price of corn, but then the fact that as a result of lower gasoline demand, there was less ethanol being blended in the price of gasoline. So we certainly saw a very rare instance during the height of the coronavirus situation in which the price of gasoline, which is nearly always above the price of ethanol, actually traded under the price of ethanol.
Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting, do you have a question for Patrick Dahan?
Well, one question I have is I spend the winters down in the tip of Texas right along the Mexican border, and I was watching gas prices during the pandemic, or the height of it anyway. And I always noticed that Wisconsin was posting the cheapest price of gasoline. I don't know if it was a misprint or was there something that caused that. They were significantly cheaper than any other state.
Yeah, it was a fairly impressive period of weeks in March in which gas prices in all 50 states were declining. But as you mentioned, Wisconsin, which is not typically amongst the lowest priced states in the country, quickly fell to the lowest average by far, by some 20 cents a gallon. It was in first place with the lowest average. And there's not necessarily a whole lot of rhyme or reason why that may have happened. Clearly, Wisconsin became somewhat of a battleground for retailers to lower prices, but it may have something to do with the fact that Wisconsin, unlike most states, has a unfair sales act, or what's better known as a price floor on retail margins. That is, gas stations cannot sell gasoline at a loss. And knowing that their price basically included a markup, stations may have been quicker to pass along the discounts, knowing that they would still be protected if they lower prices quicker. Certainly a very interesting situation. And since then, of course, Wisconsin is now kind of back normal in where it normally is, slightly under the national average, but certainly there was aggressive competition in Wisconsin, and I surmise much of it had to do with the fact that retailers were essentially guaranteed a margin, which is not the case in many states. And during this pandemic, stations have been very slow to lower prices simply because they're dealing with in some cases, 50 to 70% decline in gasoline demand, and they're being very cautious, or they were very cautious about lowering prices too quickly.
Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities, do you have a question?
Back in May of 2020, you had an interview, and you said the wild card that people weren't considering was looking at the refineries that process oil, and that they need to get back into the game as demand starts to back up. The key to that was refinery utilization. How do you see that progressing, and your thoughts maybe through the rest of the year?
It's been very interesting to see what has developed over the last month and a half, certainly out of left field, I would say. Since some of those comments, we have been dealing with a environment where refineries have seen a slight uptick in refinery utilization, responding to the increase in demand that we've started to see. Gasoline demand still somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% below year-ago levels. But it has risen, notably, in some cases, 30% off lows. Now, the increase in utilization has been less than 5 percentage points, meaning that refineries are scaling up. But the interesting dynamic here is that due to the slowdown in the broader economy, diesel, which is a heavy oil more utilized by commerce, farmers, agriculture, and indeed school buses, which haven't been running for the better part of 3 months, have been sitting idle. And that has essentially destroyed a significant amount of diesel demand. So prior to coronavirus, heavier oils were actually fetching more of a margin than gasoline was. And so refineries were tilting in the favor of producing more of those heavy oils, including distillate. But now with demand for distillate having plummeted, refineries may not need to increase utilization rates. They may instead skew their runs to process more light crude oil, which would then yield more gasoline and less distillate at the same percentage rates that they're currently running.
Chip Nellinger from Blue Reef Agri Marketing.
Yeah, I was just wondering, obviously there's been a rapid decrease in the demand with the, shelter in place across the country and mostly across the world. We have massive supplies of crude oil, offshore in tankers at the Gulf. How do you see that balance that we've, low prices have shut production down, but yet we have this massive supply, tanks are full and offshore. How do you see that battle taking place, and what kind of a range would you expect in crude oil going forward?
Well, as you mentioned, there have been dozens of VLCCs, very large crude carriers, parked along the U.S. coast. Well documented that we had millions of barrels of Saudi crude oil several weeks ago sitting off the coast of California. But as WTI, West Texas Intermediate crude oil, and Brent crude oil, as oil prices have found support in recent weeks on the heels of gasoline demand that's recovered, some of those tankers have been offloaded. We saw U.S. imports surge in the last 2 weeks, according to the Energy Information Administration, which is the department under the Department of Energy. And so we have started to see some of those imports land in the U.S. And I would expect that as oil prices continue to hold near $37, $38 a barrel in the 30s, that we may see more of that oil that's sitting offshore come into port and enter the U.S. inventory system. And as you mentioned, U.S. oil production numbers have certainly plunged from 13 million barrels ahead of coronavirus now to closer to 11 million barrels. And with the economy still struggling, U.S. production numbers may not recover as quickly as we may see some global production recover. So it's in the months ahead, it's really going to be contingent on whether or not gasoline demand can continue to drive the economy, whether it will pull up distillate demand, whether low gas prices will pull the economy up, or whether the overall weight of a slowdown in the economy would pull gasoline demand down. We're clearly looking at 40 million Americans that are out of work now. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see which way the economy goes. But I could see crude oil prices, if there are no second waves, I think we're a little bit overvalued at $37, but I think we shouldn't slip beneath, say, $25 to $26 a barrel, barring any major shifts in where we are right now as a result of coronavirus.
I'd like to take up some political issues, if you dare, that is, as it's related to ethanol. I'm wondering whether you have an idea how much ethanol really needs to be in a gallon of gasoline for the octane rating to maintain a level at 87, 89, 93, whatever it happens to be, and how much of that 10% blend the oil industry would like to recapture if it can.
Well, I think almost guaranteed, unless you're Valero, which is a company that has a significant amount of ethanol production, I would think that most of the oil industry, given their stance, would probably want to claw a lot of that back. We have seen them applying for SREs, refinery exemptions, small refinery exemptions, to try and dodge those RFS requirements that require them to blend ethanol into gasoline. Having said that, in the last 5 years, we've been in somewhat of a shortage of alkylate, which is a blending component to gasoline that pulls the octane rating higher. In addition, on the last decade, manufacturers have been moving towards vehicles that meet CAFE standards. Well, prior to President Trump dismantling some of those, manufacturers had been utilizing higher octane to get higher fuel efficiency in some cases. And so that led to that, and the low quality of crude oil in some U.S. Regions was causing alkylate inventories to suffer. And the price of premium was trading, and in many places at the retail level, is still $1 per gallon more than regular gasoline. And it, as it turns out, of course, ethanol's octane rating is somewhere in the neighborhood of 95 to 100 AKI, which is significantly higher than gasoline. And if manufacturers had the grounds for it, instead of utilizing premium with alkylate at a much higher cost, I think manufacturers could move towards a premium fuel that would be, say, E30 or E35. Unfortunately, we're not there yet. There's a lot of red tape that has held that back. Of course, just last year, the ethanol industry and agriculture was able to convince the administration to approve E15 year-round, and that's new. But it'll be interesting to see if in the years ahead, the relatively low cost of corn and its high octane level could act as a substitute to alkylate, which has been pretty pricey.
Anybody else have other questions they want to ask?
Where are we at on consumption compared to maybe like a year ago? You know, June is usually the start of the summer vacations and travel for families and whatnot. So demand for fuel picks up. Where are we at? Are we 70% of what we were last year or 60% of last year on consumption, or where are we at?
We're somewhere in the neighborhood of just under three quarters of average consumption. So that would put us somewhere right around 70% down. Anecdotally, depending on state, 22 to about 28%. We have certainly recovered from when U.S. demand briefly touched 50% lower. Like I said, we are somewhere in the neighborhood of 22 to 28%, depending on the state. And the national demand numbers are down about 26% from a year ago.
Now, where are we at on diesel fuel and transportation? Because there was a lot of our manufactured goods and stuff travel through semis. Where are we at on diesel consumption compared to a year ago?
Well, diesel's been certainly an interesting story. In fact, just in recent days here in Chicago, I've seen something that we haven't seen for quite a number of years, and that is that the price of retail diesel was under that of regular gasoline, and that's something that we have not seen in quite some time. May have to go back from the days that ultra-low sulfur diesel was implemented. But currently, as of yesterday's report from the Energy Information Administration, demand is anemic at best for diesel. And we are looking at total distillate inventories that now provide 64 days, I believe is the number I tweeted yesterday, 64 days of distillate demand covered. That's up from just 38 days a year ago. So distillate inventories are surging. But overall, the price of distillate has even seen some strength, even though inventories continue to increase. I think that's being pulled by higher by optimism that perhaps there will be some recovery in distillate demand.
You mentioned that we're starting to pull some of that supplies off sea, off the coast, in at our $35, $37 prices. The question then, or thought pattern of mine comes in, how long will it take to work through that? And is $37 or $35 high enough to start increasing our country's production? So maybe what type of timetable do you see that starting to increase? And is the price high enough for us to start producing again?
I think it certainly depends on geography and the type of crude oil and what it may be fetching. You look at the Permian Basin, there may be some oil producers that are very carefully looking at the $37 mark that we see today and may be getting back into the game very cautiously. Certainly, I think given the depths of the situation that we've seen in the last 8 weeks, that some oil producers are probably still watching for more recovery before they start opening the taps back up. But it would not surprise me, as long as the situation continues to improve, that U.S. production may decrease for a couple more weeks yet before we start to see any sign of an increase. And it would be a very slow, cautious pace. We may not get back to oil production numbers that we saw prior to this for quite some time, if we get there. I think that the wild card is really the U.S. economy and how quickly we recover from this. Really, it's anyone's best guess if gasoline demand will get back up to normal averages for another 6 to 12 months. And if we get there sooner, I think that certainly will lead more oil producers to get back in business a little bit sooner than that. But I would still think that the best case for most producers getting back online may be measured in months, maybe even a year or two, depending on, you know, exactly how things improve from here on out.
Finally, Patrick DeHaan, this question, as you think about the next 10 years and gasoline demand as it relates to the development of hybrid electric and electric vehicles across the globe and in the United States, how do you see gasoline demand playing out?
I mean, it's really interesting. You asked me that 3 months ago, and I probably would have had a somewhat different answer. I think prior to coronavirus, I think that EV adoption was accelerating more notably as of late. We still were near gasoline demand that rivaled all-time record levels. So from that standpoint, EVs are not necessarily making a dent in gasoline demand that's clearly visible. And with the era of low gas prices, a national average of under $2 is not really incentivizing many Americans to go buy EVs. I think depending on how long the situation lasts, it will eventually lead to lower EV adoption. And that's why I think Tesla took the lead of lowering some prices on their vehicles. I still do see a eventual transition to EVs, but then again, it depends on how long demand remains diminished from this coronavirus situation. It could slow down the adoption rate or put it several years behind. But I think over the next 10 to 20 years, we will start to see more of an exponential growth in the adoption of electric vehicles.
So now let's turn our attention to the marketplace in particular. Merrill Crowley, I think I'll start with you. As you look at this week in the corn and the soybean market, especially the Thursday jump in the marketplace, does it give you hope that the price options for producers might be opening up in the month of June, especially for old crop?
Yeah, it's certainly a nice technical move. I mean, I see a situation here where technically you've got a lot of good things going for corn, but not much in the realm of fundamentally. Soybeans, on the other hand, tend to have more of a fundamental bias to them that suggests higher prices. And today's move broke out of our ranges. As I looked back on that, I'm just looking at particular ranges that we could rally to based on the most common rallies we have had since 2014, and that would suggest December corn rallies with a minimum, a most common rally, so there was a lot of rallies around 18%, and average rallies, nothing in the high end, so trying to keep it down because of the situation we have. And for me, that would, from our current lows, suggest D-scorn maybe 374, 385, no soybeans, 963, and amazingly enough, almost 10 bucks. Now, that in relationship to halfway back, D-scorn is halfway back from its decline at 365, no soybeans at 907. So kind of gives you an idea that things are going to be suppressed unless we can see more demand show up. And that's the whole situation here. Prices are where they're at with commodities because of lack of demand. It's that simple. And until we see some of that demand come back, and how much of that demand that does come back will have a big effect on how far we rally up. And currently, I just look at it kind of in a reverse. It's hard for me to see the demand get much lower at this point. Therefore, I think our lows could be in. So I see that as a solid thing, and I look for anywhere to a 50% and maybe even higher rally back. And that goes for old crop as well as new crop. We have seen some basis improvement. It hasn't been a lot, but that's encouraging. So, and some of our spreads have narrowed. So I guess I have a positive attitude with everything in mind, not just, say, the technical.
Chip Nellinger, do you carry that same kind of positive attitude, and can you look forward into next week's Thursday USDA World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate for me as well?
Yeah, I do agree with Merrill. I think a lot of this is technical. You've got the seasonals kind of with the wind at our backs as well, with all the uncertainty coming up here in June, July, and August with the weather situation. And I think we can't overlook the currency issues here, too. We've seen a big break in the dollar. We've finally seen the Brazilian currency rally sharply against the dollar as well. And I think that, you know, more than anything, has created a little bit of, you know, speculative buying. The funds probably got a little too far over their skis in the corn market with a big short position there, and all the uncertainty with the growing season debt ahead of us probably has them coming out of some shorts. I think the market's kind of looking past this June report. I don't really expect many changes on that. I think the market's, you know, pretty well traded, you know, a 3.4-ish billion bushel corn carryout. And now we've got to see, you know, way ahead of us how crop conditions and heat and moisture you know, fare out into the next 90 days, say. So I don't expect many changes. I think if you could still see some technical buying and a good, strong close for the week, it's going to drive some additional fund buying. I do have one eye peeled on the dollar, though. I think that's very important going forward.
Now, Dan Zwicker, on Thursday afternoon when you talked during the closing market report, and you've accused me before of being bearish most of the time, and since we work together, I suppose you have some insight into my psyche, at least from some years ago. Where do you think we are technically?
Well, we technically, we've turned the corner. I do believe that April low is going to go down as probably at least a pre-harvest low anyway. Now, we may come back down and test it depending upon what size of crop we have. But I think we priced in the worst of everything, I think, during the month of April, and now we're slowly recovering. Two things that's going to make this thing go higher. Number one, we're going to have some kind of supply tightening feature come into play. Now, whether that's weather, disease, you know, smaller acres and what the trade anticipated was planted, maybe on the June report, because demand is probably going to be awful slow to come on quick enough to tighten up the balance sheet. So we're going to have a supply tightening feature, which means some weather issues as we go through the growing season to pull down the national average price. The other thing, which I think is beginning to develop, is a weaker dollar. It's quite clear the way the administration has acted, the way the Fed has acted since the pandemic took hold, is a quantitative easing or printing of money. I think the Fed owns everybody's house mortgage. I don't think any bankers are on the hook at all for house mortgages. I think the Fed owns them all. We got, you know, people basically skipping mortgage payments for the time being, which is just being added on to their total note. I saw a statistic that was really scary on commercial real estate, which I think that's probably in bigger problems than anything, is shopping malls and commercial real estate that holds small businesses, office buildings. Everybody's learned how to work from home. Companies are going to probably allow more people to work from home, so they don't need that office space. But it looks to me like the government and the Fed is just going to print money. And I don't necessarily look for a 70s type inflation. I think it's just going to be one of these things where it's a devaluation, currency devaluation. Every time you go to the store, it's just going to take more dollars to buy stuff. It's not like we're short of anything and we're chasing goods higher through what we call as inflation, where you have a shortage of a supply and you got a lot of dollars and we're chasing stuff higher, it's just going to be more of a currency devaluation because there's going to be so many dollars out there. So, but we're going to see that happen around the world too. I mean, the United States ain't going to be the only one that's going to print money. So that's going to be interesting. And I think that's one of the reasons why gold has finally, you know, gold has kind of been messing around, turning higher for the last year, year and a half, and it's finally catching on here. Now, you know, how high gold goes, I don't know. How high silver goes, I don't know. But as currency devalues, precious metal values are going to increase. Commodity prices in general is going to increase because it's going to take more dollars to produce them. When a farmer goes to buy his seed, his fertilizer, his fuel, and everything, it's going to just take more money to do that. So I see that currency devaluation as probably something bullish for commodity prices, but it may not necessarily be bullish, period, you know.
Right. So I'm wondering, in that respect, does a higher price mean very much in the ag community? And how does the primary asset that floats ag, which is, you know, the value of land, get managed in this process? Have you thought about that, Dan, at all?
Good question. Like I said, I don't think any lender is at risk. I think if you had opened up the Fed, if the Fed would be transparent, I think you would be surprised how much money the Fed has lent all kinds of entities over the past several years, and then especially here. So I think everything's going to stay in relatively tight hands. Now, so I think, you know, land prices, I mean, there's going to be some softness in some areas, but I'm not, if the Fed owns all the debt and they just keep printing money, I'm not too sure we'll have what we call as a, what we view as a normal correction, an economic correction, because they're just going to keep printing money. And as they print money, then that holds the value of stuff. It maybe not necessarily chases it higher. I think the biggest thing that farmers have to worry about is real estate taxes. I think real estate taxes are destined to just go through the roof. They've already gone through the roof in many states, and they're going to go higher yet. I think it could very well, real estate taxes could be as much as cash rent values at some point in time in many areas. So I think that's the biggest, because this slowdown in economic activity has blown a hole in every local government budget, state budget, county budget, city budget, township budget, you know, library budget. That just has totally blown a hole in them. And sure, they're going to get some help from Washington, but it's not going to make up for what they've lost. And the only way I see them getting that money back is raising real estate values until probably people rebel or totally protest and won't pay the bills. But I think that's going to be a big problem as we go down the road as far as home ownership values. Now, I think states like, you know, the states that are already been in decline, losing population prior to coronavirus, I think that trend is going to continue. And the states that have been growing prior to coronavirus is going to continue to grow. I was reading the Houston Chronicle this morning, and there's a big spike up in home value prices during the month of April or May. So the house market in Houston is strong, and that's after the oil catastrophe. Now, Houston used to be primarily oil, but it's diversified, so the economy is not totally tied to oil. But I think the state of Texas, I think values are going to stay strong, like in Texas and Florida, where people have been moving to, people that's been moving out of states, the New England states, Illinois. I just see that trend continuing, and that's going to continue to put a lot of pressure on those state budgets, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on home values and that stuff.
Well, Patrick, Merrill, and Chip, I was thinking that we were going to talk about higher prices and feel good about them. I'm not sure that Dan has made that as likable if the value of a higher priced bushel is not that great. So fundamentally, what do producers need to think about, Chip, in prepping themselves for the rest of this year and trying to gird their operations, I suppose, for really, really tight times?
Yeah, well, the other thing that's thrown in there is crop insurance. And honestly, it's counterintuitive because on top of crop insurance, we have the PLC payments as well. And as prices rally, particularly into October for crop insurance, we have a real black hole of revenue. And that comes about basically 370 December corn at ATH yields. So it's kind of counterintuitive. Obviously, we want prices to rally. But if they end up at 370 for the month of October, that's the worst place it can come from a revenue standpoint on crop insurance. So I think one thing that's critically important is everyone just review what your guarantee is. Make some good educated guesses as to what your farm yield is going to be as we progress through the growing season, because that's really critically important this year as it relates to your total farm revenue. Obviously, I think we need to be sellers of rallies in here. I think that South America has proven that they can produce big crops. They can be extremely competitive, and they've stolen a lot of business away from us. And one thing we haven't talked about is the continuing China saga, and that is not going very well. It's in my opinion, escalated, on a daily and weekly basis. And I don't know that one day we don't wake up and, see the total collapse of the phase one trade deal and an escalation there. And that would not be good development for us, but very good for Brazil. So I think a lot of things go in there. But first and foremost is a review of where we're at on crop insurance on an individual basis and how that relates to our total revenue in both, a different range of yields and prices. And it's counterintuitive, but a rally, at least for the month of a sustained rally into October, would not be great for a crop insurance revenue standpoint.
I think I did see a couple of headlines from some major publications this week that said phase one was dead. Of course, nothing out of Washington, D.C. or Beijing at this point on that issue. Merrill Crowley, how do you get producers ready for what looks like a really tough time?
That is a great question, because everybody's wanting to look at higher prices. I really have to go along with a lot of the points that Chip made. There's two things that seem to just pop out at me, and it could be just maybe I had too much to drink the night before. I don't know. But when we talk about phase one collapsing, when did it take off? I mean, we made an agreement. But when did we really see any demand come from it? And so far, I really don't think we've seen a whole heck of a lot from that. Like I said, I think our demand's gone, and it's hard to see any less. I suppose there could be less if they quit buying from us entirely, but Brazil is being thought to getting close to running out of their beans. So then where will they go to find beans, to provide for their needs? And so that part, the other thing is the way China is acting. I mean, anybody that asks for information about coronavirus or stands up to them about this Hong Kong matter that's being handled, man, just right away, oh, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. It's like a little kid, and it makes me think that they're in trouble. Their economy is more in trouble maybe than what they think. Their reserves may be less than what they were saying. I mean, they're supposed to have 200 some million bushels, metric ton of corn. Yet it wasn't too long ago they were saying they only had 54 million. I know they're selling it out of the reserves, but if they're planning on taking care of their reserves or improving them, they've got to find more grain than what Brazil's got. And they've got to, the only place I really see right now for them to come is U.S. So getting back, I guess, more to the point, farmers are going to have to be more willing to sell somewhere in the 360, 370 area if we can get that high. And the second thing is we don't know where the weather is, because there are talk of we're moving into La Nina. If that were to take effect, and from what I've looked back in the past, it seems like La Nina, the transference from El Nino to La Nina is where we tend to get more droughty years. So far it's not on our radar, may not happen, but if you're going to lock in prices at this time of the year with margins as tight as they are, you need to be flexible on what you're going to do.
Let's get a final word, I think, now from each of you. I believe we'll start with Chip Nellinger at Blue Reef Agri-Marketing.
Well, I just reiterate what I said before and what I preach a lot. You got to have a plan. It's nice that we finally turned the corner here, and it does look technically like the market's going to put a little bit of a rally in, but what then? And crop insurance is a big part of that. What's your revenue guarantee? Keep that in the back of your mind. We've got some backstop there with, the PLC program as well. And so we have to keep that in mind, have a plan of attack, know what we're going to do no matter what happens in the market. I would say that the headwinds coming are demand, China, and, potentially a big crop without a supply disruption here. And so this rally could be short-lived, and we got to be ready, willing, and able to reward it and have a plan of attack.
Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities.
I think pretty much going to reiterate what I said. You've got to, like Chip said, got to have the plan, no doubt about it. And things have to be done in a way that you can be flexible enough to take advantage of any weather problems that may come along or any unforeseen things that we could have coming in 2020.
And Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting.
Well, I think as long as prices are below the crop insurance price, I think, you go slow. If you do anything, it's got to be highly flexible. There are some uninsured bushels that you have to maybe market. But at current price levels, I and crop insurance guarantees, I guess I would be very slow, very deliberate, and see how much of a seasonal rally we can get going here during the month of June and maybe as we go on into July.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like online at willag.org, willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Patrick DeHaan of Gas Buddy. He's the head of petroleum analysis there in Chicago, Illinois. Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois. Chip Nellinger from Blue Reef Agri-Marketing in Morton, Illinois. And Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.